Welcome to What Are We Talking About Today, the podcast where we literally talk about everything. I'm your host, Gigi. Let's jump into it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to What Are We Talking About Today. I just want to say, I know last week's episode about toxic parents and family was really, really heavy for some people. And I did have a good little discussion with a couple of people on my Instagram. And I'm so sorry that people had to go through that or are still going through it. Like I said, I can't tell you to cut your family off. You got to do what's best for you. And I know people who have cut their family off and they're doing great. You know, they're growing personally. They're learning to love themselves. And I hope each and every one of you can love yourself. And some of y'all might be like, I already do, but you never can have too much love. Just want to say that, especially self-love. You can never have a lot. But today, this episode isn't going to be any more lighthearted than last week's episode. It's bad. it's about mainly families, the murdering, trigger warning, murder. You know, they're doing that to each other. There's five stories I'm going to get into about Thanksgiving murders, and only one doesn't actually involve a family. It's just, well, you'll see. It's just a dude waiting, plotting in his garage. But yeah, you know, Thanksgiving usually brings families together to bond over, you know, a nice meal, maybe some football, maybe play a little game or two. But in this case, or cases, it resulted in just bloodshed. And, you know, for Americans, that's just a time for us to, like, really just bond with the family. Even though there are some toxic members in the family, usually on the holidays, we suck it up and we just deal with it. But sometimes it just erupts in gunfire. And, you know, a lot of people are just like, oh, yeah, you know, that's normal for us. We fight and argue. And usually that's how a lot of these events happened, and they ended in death, which is, you know, not great. It's not pleasant for anybody, none of the parties involved, but they happen. So let's go ahead and jump into the stories. Trigger warnings for this episode include gun violence, stabbing, murder, dismemberment, and cannibalism. First up, we have a 23-year-old Egyptian-born model, Omaima Nelson. On Thanksgiving Day, 1993, she grabbed a pair of scissors and repeatedly plunged them into the chest and stomach of her 56-year-old husband, Bill. As Bill was laid out on the floor trying to get away from her, she grabbed a clothing iron and she beat him with it to the point where the iron actually broke in her hand. She unleashed her fury because over the sexual terror and the abuse she, like, endured from him, he also, like, would pimp her out, just for, like, anything, for rent, cash, and in one case, for a car. Once he finally expired, she butchered his body on the kitchen floor. She boiled his hands in oil to remove the fingerprints, and she stuck his head in the freezer so she could later break out his teeth. In symbolic revenge, Omaima made a point to castrating her husband. She took the pieces and stuffed them in trash bags, and she also put some more of it down the garbage disposal. While doing this, it occurred to her that she hadn't eaten yet. So what she decided to do was eat his ribs. She told the psychiatrist that the ribs tasted so sweet. She had prepared them with barbecue sauce and put them in the oven. At a time when, like, this alleged cannibalism was going on, they had only been married for, like, less than 3 weeks. So you know, they had only known each other for a total of 5. And 3 weeks after being married, she is chowing down on her husband's remains. Over the next few days, she had the help of some of her ex-boyfriends dispose of the body parts. They weren't good at this because on December 1st, police got a tip about body parts being seen in a parked car that belonged to Bill Nelson. Obviously, the parts were his. So these people sucked at disposing of the body. And I would never want them to help me cover up a crime, obviously. The officers dropped in by Omima's house to inform her of the discovery. And while they were there, they found newspaper wrapped pieces of Bill inside the refrigerator. They immediately arrested her for first degree murder. She claimed it was self-defense. And she said that in addition to her being pimped out, Bill was into BDSM. And he would routinely bound her against her will and rape her. And she claimed that he even raped her that morning on Thanksgiving Day. And she basically feared for her life, so she decided to kill him before he killed her. At the time of this slaying, she was already facing 3 felony charges regarding a 1990 incident, in which she slapped around an ex after she tied him up and held him at gunpoint for some money. Remarkably, the Omima Nelson saga grew increasingly soared once it got to trial. First, Omima's interview with a psychiatrist came to light, in which she detailed putting on a red dress, red shoes, and a red hat. And she did all this before cooking Bill's ribs. She also stated that, I did his ribs just like in a restaurant. It's so sweet. It's so delicious. I like mine tender. The psychiatrist said in all the 20 years he's worked that he has never had a conversation so bizarre and so psychotic. And she, basically that while this was happening, that she was in a psychotic state when she killed him and ate him. So the defense decided to paint like a picture of how she grew up, and they said it was terrible. She had been subject to female genital mutilation, and she basically submitted herself to sexual humiliation so she just could survive. So she did whatever, by like whatever means necessary, so she could just grow up in Egypt. They also said that Bill was a sick and twisted sadist who tortured his wife sexually, physically, and psychologically. Apparently, they had adopted a kitten at one point, and while they were driving, you know, home, Bill allegedly pulled the animal from Omima's lap in a moving car and tossed it out a window. So adding to the whole sensationalism of the courtroom, they had plastered photos of Bill's deep-fried hands, frozen head, and skinned torso all on the wall. And the thing is, like, during all this, I think Silence of the Lambs came out. So I've read where, like, a lot of people were basically saying, like, that's kind of where she got the idea for the cannibalism part. I didn't see anything where, like, she said anything, like, you know, like, in a psychiatrist interview or anything about her getting inspiration from that. But I just wanted to point that out. So the jury had to basically go to deliberation on January 4th, 1993. And it took them 6 days to declare that she was guilty of second-degree murder. The jury foreman stated that it was a really tough time and a really tough decision, like that they couldn't come back with a first-degree verdict. So because they couldn't find the evidence, it wasn't there. So that's why it took them so long. She got 27 years for this. And this whole time, she denies eating Bill. She came for parole in 2011, and she was like, I'm not a monster. Like, only did this for self-defense. And she also got married in jail, and she said that she never hurt her husband when they were, like, in a trailer where they had, like, couple visits. And she said there were knives there in the kitchen, and she's like, I never not, like, once thought about harming him or anything or even tried. Yeah, she didn't get off on parole. So she had to serve the rest of her time. And yeah, so that was Omima Nelson, the model who killed, castrated, and ate her husband for Thanksgiving. Next, we have 35-year-old Paul Michael Marige, who had been planning this massacre for 20 years. Now, let's get a little backstory on him. He was, at this time, an estranged recluse, but he once was a talented athlete and a standout prep school student in Miami. Now, he seemed like a great person to the outside world, but at home, he was very violent, and he would threaten his sisters all the time. At one point, one of them had to get a restraining order against him. So, let's jump to 2009, and weeks before Thanksgiving, he bought four guns and ammunition worth $2,000, and he bought them at two different shops. At one of them, he asked for a scope to be attached to a bolt-action Remington 700 rifle that he said he wanted to use for hunting. Now, let's jump to a week before Thanksgiving. He had been badgering his parents, asking about the Thanksgiving events, where is it going to be, who's all going to be there, you know, stuff like that. But he never once told them that he was coming. So his parents never alerted the hosts, Jim and Muriel Sitton, that he might be coming. Now, obviously his family knows his past. Nobody really wants him there. So, but it's one of those things where you don't really want to talk about how he is, you know. But since he wasn't coming, there was no need to even bring him up. Now, the evening of November 26th, everyone's, you know, at the Sitton's house having a great Thanksgiving meal. Paul decides to call, and he tells his mom he's coming. Now, the mom tells one of the sisters that, "I hope he doesn't come and kill us all tonight." Her daughter Lisa replied, "Mom, it came to my mind, but don't say that to Dad because Dad would get upset that we had such ideas." So the night when, you know, he came, he was very normal. There was nothing going on. You know, despite his long history of violence and threats to his sister, everything was good. Like, he showed no anger or anything towards anybody. It was a great time. They had a great conversation. Everyone's joking and laughing. They played games, had little sing-alongs, you know. It was just great. Very normal, you know, for considering how he is. It was a very normal, you know, evening. Like, no incidents happened. As, you know, the night winded down, put the kids to bed, you know, they're kind of all just hanging out, getting ready to go. He decides to pull out a handgun and, you know, start shooting people. Apparently, he only wind up shooting five people that I could find, but four perished. And two of them were his twin sisters, and one of them was pregnant. He shot his aunt once in the shoulder. And when her husband went to stop the bleeding, Paul walked up to her body that's laying on the ground, put the gun to her stomach, and shot a hole in her sternum. After that, he walked upstairs to a six-year-old girl's bedroom, shot her once, walked out, but immediately turned back around and shot her again just to make sure she was dead. When he was done, he said that he had been planning this for 20 years. After that, he, you know, fled. And he was on the run for like 2 months. He got picked up January 2nd. And when they picked him up, he seemed dazed by his own deeds and worried about his future. Records show he rambled on in a police interrogation, implicating himself in the murders without discussing them directly. He said, "It's impossible, you know, to reconcile what happened with me. It's just, it's not even real. I'm not violent. I've never been violent. I'm not a criminal or a drug addict. It's just unbelievable. What I've done to everybody." Seemingly unaware of the workings of the court system and the scale of criminal charges that would face him, he asked a police officer if he would be facing a long process. He was like, "Is it a year, 2 years?" After that, he was told that, you know, you have to wait for a trial and that could be lengthy. And he really wanted just to know, you know, what was happening next, because he really was just concerned about the time period. Like, he didn't care about really what he did. He was more worried about, like, is he going to just have to sit and wait for all this to happen before he gets a verdict? And he said, "What about afterwards? What's the worst case scenario for this?" Now, the worst case scenario for this is the death penalty. I mean, you took lives. So what the hell would else be the worst case scenario?
But he did cut a plea deal and he got 7 consecutive life sentences.
Now, the next one, I couldn't really find a lot of information. I couldn't even find like video, like courtroom footage or nothing about this one. But it was just very interesting to me because of last week's episode, we were talking about toxic parents and just how like any little thing can set them off. So this one is about alias Clay Oliver. He's a 76-year-old man. And he shot and killed his 49-year-old son over chores. Now, they had been arguing basically all morning on Thanksgiving Day for hours about chores. The chores that were supposed to be done is unclear. But at one point, the mother, Marjorie, who was 75 years old, asked her son to leave the house, but he refused. The father then went upstairs to an upstairs bedroom, retrieved a .357 caliber revolver from the nightstand, and he went back to the garage and confronted his son. Now, the dad told detectives that he exchanged about 5 words with his son before shooting him once, and he shot his son point-blank range in the head. Now, the father told the detectives that he was pissed when he went for his gun, all because his son wasn't doing chores. Now, I mean, I'm not really sure what it all was. No one is. He confirmed that his son's final words overheard by the mother was that he was trying to stand up like a man, and for that, his father was going to shoot him. A detective said Oliver did not remember saying anything to his son before firing the shot. After shooting his son, the father told investigators that he sat down on the steps still holding the gun until his wife asked him to put the weapon down. And when the officers arrived, they found him sitting, you know, on the stairs, breathing real heavy, but he was okay, and he said that he had harmed his son. He said he wasn't under the influence of anything. He just had his heart medication, and, you know, he wasn't under the any type of care for a psychiatric disorder. You know, he was basically telling them, like, you know, like a normal conversation, like he was a former steel mill worker who had served in the military. And, you know, he was still working a daily job. And he was telling them that he was still paying, you know, he was paying like the rent and making car payments for his 2 sons. And then, you know, he told them that that's who he had shot. Yeah, that's all for that one. Like I said, I really couldn't find much. But I just feel like just because your 40-something-year-old son is not doing something you want him to do, I don't feel like that, you know, calls for, you know, shooting him, especially in the head. Like, did you really think that was a good call? But, you know, whatever. Like I said, I still couldn't find anything. I couldn't even find, like, if he was sentenced to life or they put him to death or anything. Like, everything just basically tells us what happened the day of Thanksgiving in 2009, and that's it. So if y'all want to try to find it, y'all can. Next, we have Byron David Smith, who was a retired security engineering officer. He was described as a loner and had never married or had kids. He had also became very paranoid the months leading up to this incident because his home had been broken into several times before. For a majority of the break-ins, he blamed Haley Kiefer, who was 18, and her 17-year-old cousin, Nicholas Brady. Now, on November 22nd, 2012, Byron had gone out to visit some neighbors. He noticed Haley's car sitting outside, and he told his friends he needed to leave. When Byron came home, he turned on the home security devices that he had set up, and he waited in a chair in his basement with a gun and sat there for hours. Eventually, Nicholas Brady comes into the home first. He walked into the basement and Byron shot him 3 times, twice on the stairs and once more when he fell off the stairs. He begins to wrap up Nicholas's body in a tarp and he is taunting this dead person. He eventually finished wraps him up, and he drags him into another room. Byron reloaded his gun and waited for Haley. Haley is heard calling Nicholas's name out, and you can hear her walking upstairs looking for him. Eventually, she starts to go downstairs to the basement, and that is where Byron shoots her. His gun got jammed, and he says, "Oh, sorry about that."
Byron then shoots her again, this time in her torso area and next to her left eye. Haley is heard screaming and saying, "Oh my God." He also taunted her as well, called her derogatory names, and then places her on top of her deceased cousin. She is alive for all of this. So Byron puts the gun up to her chin and shoots her one last time. Byron does not call the police until the next day because he didn't want to bother them on Thanksgiving. The police were told that Haley and Nicholas were killed because they had tried to rob his house. Byron told the cops that Haley was actually laughing about the incident after she was shot. However, he seemed to have forgotten that he had turned on his recording devices, and Haley isn't laughing at all, but she is screaming in pain. Byron also told the police that he fired a good clean finish into Haley's head. Throughout the whole investigation, there was a debate of whether it was murder or self-defense. Byron obviously claimed that it was self-defense because they had broken his house before and he was simply afraid for his life. Now, there's something called the Castle Doctrine Law that they wanted to, you know, use as a thing, you know, like to help him get off on self-defense. It's basically says that the person has a right to protect their home or themselves by using it. Deadly force. The police said that Byron did many things that day to prove that it was not self-defense, but maybe even premeditated. He moved his car that day, but said that he had moved it to clean his garage. The police's theory is that he moved it so Nicholas and Haley would think he wasn't home. Byron also recorded 6 hours worth of audio, and one of the things he had said was, "In your left eye," and Haley was shot in her left eye. He has gotten convicted of 2 counts of first degree murder with premeditation and 2 counts of second degree murder. He is, a for lifer. He has life in prison without parole. To end things on a little bit of a lighter note, I chose Shanika Alsup, and she had family over her house for Thanksgiving in 2012. The 27-year-old and her half-brother, 23-year-old Antonio Wallace, got in, you know, a sibling spat about the food being served. Now, we don't really know what it's about. I couldn't find anything if it was just because, you know, maybe the brother didn't like what the girl cooked. I'm not sure. But whatever it was, Shanika decides to take the serving fork and stab him in the neck with it. Now, Antonio survived, which is a blessing, because he almost bled out, because from the apartment to where they found him in the front of the complex, like, there was blood, like trails of blood. And his shirt, he had a white shirt on that was basically red, and he was bleeding out bad. Shanika went to jail for first-degree assault, second-degree assault, and reckless endangerment. Now, I couldn't really find where they said that she was, like, convicted of it, but they just said that that's what she was charged with. I just want to thank everyone who stuck around and listened and bared with the dark and heavy murders and the assaults that we went through today. I promise you next week's podcast is going to be nothing like this. It's going to be really fun and it's going to be really lighthearted. Maybe a little educational. You never know. But once again, I want to thank you guys for the support. I really do appreciate it. All of my social media for personal page and the podcast page will be on the link to the link tree. Just check the description. And I'll see you next week. Thank you. Thank you for listening to What Are We Talking About Today. Please follow and turn on notifications so you know when to upload next. Please share with your friends, family, and those coworkers you really don't like, but they think you do.